You're listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Westwave Audio, LA's new API dealer. And now from the Nowcast Network studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez, and before we get going, let me introduce the guys. Over here on my right, we've got Scott Gershon.
Hello.
And over here on my left, we've got Rob Arbitier.
Hello there, Mike.
Bobby and Martin are not with us.
Hello!
Well, if they were here, that's what they'd say.
But I think Bobby's at like a bat mitzvah in Dallas.
Yeah, in Texas.
Like
that. Well, that was the excuse he used.
A bat mitzvah in Texas?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
And Martin is...
Hispanic, it's a bat
mitzvah. That's right.
And which brings us to our guest for today. Today we have Marvin Caesar, president and founder of Apex Systems LTD. Marvin, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
So we're gonna have a really good time. First of all, before we get going, we're gonna talk more about this on the second half of the podcast. But everything you're hearing right now is coming through the Apex new unit. Do you want to say a little bit about the unit? So that
there's a lot to say about the unit, but we should put it. Just generally speaking, it's a mic preamp with lots of processing power, and if people like the sound of what we're saying, not necessarily the words, but how it's sounding, they'll appreciate what these pieces are doing.
I think we're all sitting here feeling like we sound a lot better than we usually do.
Well, I do. I feel like I sound like a 18-year-old as opposed to a 12-year-old. So, but anyhow, we'll talk more about that, but he's graciously brought down a rack full of gear that he's going to try to take out of the place, but
but may have to grab his ankles.
I mean, it's a great unit. I mean, as soon as I started hearing my voice through it, it was like, wow, it was pretty amazing. So we'll talk about that on the second half, but thank you, Marvin, for coming down and
my pleasure.
And bringing that. Before we get into some stuff, two things. First of all, last time on the podcast, we announced our gear giveaway. And Scott, what our gear giveaway is, since you were asking, is Rob has some DMP7s in his garage, and he wanted to...
It wasn't like a planned giveaway. I don't remember how it came up, but I just said, would someone please take these things off my hands?
He had like three units, and then I said, okay, we're going to give them away. So I opened it up for people to send in emails to audio@nowcastnetwork.com. Mm-hmm. And we got some people that sent some stuff in, but we've got a winner.
Yay!
Wow.
We've got a winner because I kind of – well, you'll see.
Well, you say they're a winner. They're going to end up with the DMP7.
Well, let me read you the email, okay?
Is that 4-bit?
It aspired to be.
Okay, here's the email.
That's what it's worth.
Let's hear this email.
Are you still giving away some free DMP7s? Here's my sad tale about why I could use one of those suckers. I've been four tracking with a Yamaha MT50 for 3 years. Okay, stop. MT50 four track on cassette. That's all
I
need to say.
Okay.
And being that I'm a university student, I've got a budget of pretty much nothing for gear. I will send you my two albums of music, which we're going to get his two albums of music because I want them. It's avant-garde fuzz rock. I have recorded on my 4-track, and will send you the third album when it's done. If you know the shipping, I might be able to cover it. I live in Maine. David T. Crosby.
Wow.
David D. Crosby,
you are the winner of a DMP7.
DMP7. We just have to figure out how to get it to you.
And you know what, David? If you email me, I'm going to cover the shipping.
Really? Okay.
Wow. So, but don't expect it anytime like quick. It's not going to be overnight. It's going to be like ground shipping on the back.
A couple snails, you know. Right.
That just seems appropriate for the DMP7.
But
hey, the DMP7 did some pretty cool tricks. I mean, it had good effects processors built in.
Right.
You know, at the time, I was thrilled to have it, believe me.
Oh, I know. Well, the thing that kind of stuck out is, A, for, you know, some of the other emails were like, well, I just want to have it and stuff. And this guy has been tracking for, on a 4-track cassette, an MT50, for 3 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, cassettes died like 9 years ago.
Yeah.
So I think it's right about now in this whole timeline of gear, he's ready to go into the digital realm.
Yeah, I think so.
So I just think it made sense. So,
and do you have all of his contact info?
No, David's going to have to send it to me.
Okay.
I have his
email
address.
We just have to email him the DMP7, which is not going to really be that easy.
Make a PDF out of it.
Yeah, there you go.
Hey, but are we going to give away the other two?
Please.
Okay. So we got one
But it
down.
Has to be to a good home.
Okay. One down. Well, I think this one's going to be.
That seems like a good home.
A good home. So we got one down. We've got two more to give away. Mm-hmm. So we're going to open it up now. If you want a DMP7, and we're going to cover the shipping to you.
Wow.
Yes. Wow.
Then send us an email at audio@nowcastnetwork.com and just tell us why you deserve one of Rob's old used.
I mean, it's debatable which is worth more, the shipping or the mixer. I'm not sure about that one.
Sad Tales definitely win points. Over
yeah,
this
and next week, the Commodore 64.
And keep in mind, these mixers have been sitting around for a really long time.
Oh, yeah. So there's no guarantee that they're going to work.
Well, no, they should work.
They work, but I remember they had little rubber belts that would drive the motorized faders up and down, and I remember those things would dry out and I'd have to replace them. Yeah, there's definitely no guarantee, but they've been sitting in a good home for a really long time. So as long as they go to a good home.
And let's face it, they kind of look kind of cool, though.
They do look cool.
They still look cool. So if you just want to have them for, like, cool factor.
And I did a ton of commercials for them. We really did used to use them as our main mixer.
Well, there you go.
Before someone told us how bad they sounded.
So so there you go. Hey, Scott. So
hello.
If you have any gear you want to give away, you know, this is – I think this is –
I've got about a dozen Atari computers, 10 – 80s.
Well, you know what? Maybe somewhere down the road.
Those are classics.
I know. Stacy's. I got Stacy's.
All right.
I got an Epson printer, laser printer.
Okay.
For Atari computer.
Oh, for Atari.
For Atari.
Oh, that would be hard.
Wow. I mean,
so if anyone's listening from like 15 years ago, we got your gear ready for you.
That's right. Okay. Well, so that's the first thing. So congratulations, David. I guess it's appropriate to say congratulations.
I think so.
The next thing I want to say is we're on iTunes now. So we are posted on iTunes. So if you search for Audio Nowcast, you can find the Audio Nowcast. And let's hope we do good. Not too good.
Hi, world.
So does this mean Apple's going to do a commercial with us sitting there in black silhouette?
That's right.
No.
Talking?
That's
with
right.
Some really hip music playing?
No, but it'll be easier to tell friends about the podcast because you can just say Audio Nowcast, look it up in iTunes, and it'll be able to find it for us.
Nice.
Cool.
And so – and I can actually – I think we have a number too. I have to check.
But it's an easy search.
Oh, yeah. It'll be an – unless you know anybody else who has an Audio Nowcast.
I don't.
But and we're listed under technology, and other keywords are like music and stuff. But it's kind of a tech show, so you know it'll be good.
Excellent.
So there we go. So now let's move on to AES. Well, first of all,
I'm the only one who wasn't there, so I'm going to do a lot of listening.
Well, funny thing was about AES, talking with Greg from our last podcast. Just so happens that Greg's booth. Was right next to
the Steinberg booth.
Yeah,
was
right
next to
API.
Really?
I mean, I could look down. I can actually see him. You know, I could.
Cool.
You know, I waved a couple times. He waved back. I went over and talked to him, but that was pretty funny. But before we get going, let's start with Scott. Did you see anything over the AS that you want to talk about? Anything that was kind of
it was
gay?
Fleet Week, so I saw like an aircraft carrier and a couple jets flying overhead. No, yeah, I saw a couple things. Oh goodness, what can I get into? For the sound effects folks out there, SoundMiner's coming out with a whole another generation of librarian software, which is actually amazing. So check with those guys. That was pretty cool.
Now, SoundMiner, that's the one where you can look up keywords and it'll actually bring them into your session,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I mean, they've got something out there that they're going to be releasing rather shortly, and it's probably some of the best librarian software that I've ever seen. And we're using it not only for sound effects but for our music editing. So if you want to put all music down and you want to be able to access libraries of music cues, et cetera, et cetera. And we did a blind test of sample rate conversion, and they had the best sample rate converter software bar none.
Wow.
So we did stuff – recorded stuff for 192, brought it down to 4824. And in a blind test, it was pretty unanimous.
So it lives on your library at 192, and then when you import it
– and it could do multi-channel, so you can do 5.196, 24. Mm. Yes. Interleaved WAV files.
Wow, that's cool.
Yummy. With metadata built into it. So
– what company was that?
This is called SoundMiner. So anyway, but that was kind of cool. I saw the smallest recorder over at Zaxcom. I've ever seen a little 4824 bit that's about this big.
This is a podcast. Oh, this big doesn't mean it's the size of an elephant, folks.
Okay. No, it's about about the size of a 50-cent piece.
Wow.
And it was a little compact flash recorder that they were showing, the two channel. And I actually think it's probably too small, but it's like kind of the watch thing. You know, got the calculator, and you know, just can't reach the buttons on it. But it was rather cool. And then also
size of a 50-cent piece. Yeah, I'm still amazed that.
Yeah, hey,
man, I can just see it. Anybody seen my
our master recorder?
Talking about stealth recorders, I can't even find the recorder. It's in my pocket somewhere.
Man, that's a little too small for me, but that's okay.
Yeah. Also, I can't say anything about the startup of a new organization, a branch out of GANG. I can't say anything about that, called IESD, which is Interactive Entertainment Sound Designers, that's going to be coming out in 2007, which we're pretty excited about.
That you can't talk about.
That I can't talk about.
Okay.
I can't talk about, you know, how it's going to represent all the sound designers in the electronic medium.
Wow.
It's going to be probably 15 different functions and events a year. It's going to be huge. We're probably going to do the launch at Expression College in San Francisco in December. And we'll be on the GANG is the Game Audio Network Guild.
Right.
So, it's going to be focused on sound design and audio integration in the gaming world. But I can't talk about that.
Okay, well, okay. Don't say a word. We're not. So. Anything else? Did you see anything else that was cool?
Oh, I'll probably chime in as we go. I'm thinking about it.
Because, quite frankly, the reason why I'm asking you is because I was working a booth the whole time.
Well, you know, I mean, there's a lot. I mean, you know what's great is. In looking at technology, things that were out of price for everybody, for the common guy,
right.
is now affordable to everybody. And the ability for creative audio artists, whether it be musicians or engineers, it's all now getting to the point where the quality of audio that was out of reach for many people is now within reach for a lot of people. And it's great to see that the quality. I mean, you know, before – to have a 48-track digital studio with a big console and outboard gear and everything, a selected few could afford.
Yeah.
And now, you know, people in their homes and in their home studios. And some of it's still a little expensive for the individual, but it's not out of reach.
Did you go to the SSL? Did you go to the SSL booth and see Duality? No. That's the name of the new console.
Was it?
But Duality.
Duality?
I mean, all names that they named this thing, and they said Duality.
So was it like part mixer, part workstation controller?
Yeah.
Yeah, I got
it. But, I mean, they used to have the coolest names.
Yeah, that's a pretty terrible name.
Duality.
I just want to know what marketing guy
was. Wow, what's that? I just bought Duality.
It probably sounds better with an English accent. That's all I can
think. Well, anyhow, well, that's great. I was working a booth, so I didn't get out that much. Marvin, did you get to go around and see some cool stuff there?
Actually, I heard a lot of stuff. it felt to me much more like a NAMM show.
It did, didn't it?
Than
oh, really?
An
the
AAS
sound level
show.
Was that high?
Oh, yeah.
They allowed demonstrations of guitars, and I was behind the Gibson booth. And,
oh, great. And PRS was there.
And PRS was there. And speaker manufacturers were demonstrating their speakers on the floor.
Oh, man.
So when you're trying to explain the subtleties of a particular processor or mic pre
right.
and being blasted by a guitar amp, it's a little change. Like I said, it felt much more like a NAMM show. I will say, however, that the quality of the people, because I was in the booth the whole time, was very high. They weren't just tire kickers, as you see very often at a NAMM show.
Right, right.
They were very interested in what you had to say.
Right.
And I was very fascinated to see a lot of game people, audio for games. And they want to know how to get the most quality. They want to achieve that realism, and it's not just a toy.
Yeah.
And they're quite serious about it. One guy came by and wanted to get my advice as to how to record gunshots out in the desert. because he was going to lay them into his game.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted the most realistic gunshots that he could record. And then there were other people who were doing a lot of voice work for the games, and some broadcasters that were interested in a number of products. And what was also nice to see was a lot of students. And they had some really good questions. And it's always nice to see people wanting to learn.
I found that this show didn't seem quite as crowded as I remember other shows in San Francisco. I think the quality of people, like you were saying, of prospects were definitely high. But for some reason, I don't think there was a lot of L.A. people up there like I have seen in times past. You know, I don't know if you've noticed that or not.
It seemed much more as a local show.
Yeah.
There were some people from New York, some people from Europe, some people from Mexico, but it wasn't an international show,
right,
as I would remember a New York show and certainly L.A. shows. It didn't have that flavor to it. Right. It had its own.
Yeah.
But again, it was fairly crowded, and it was I sensed that it was a group of high-quality people.
Do you feel that, you know, it's interesting now that we've got the internet. Before, I remember the only place you would find out information of the latest, greatest new releases and understanding the information was the dealer always had the delay before it got to them, so the buzz was going. But now with the internet, you can go on to the company's website, you know, check out your favorite companies, check what they're doing. Hey, they got some new products out. Then be able to go to your local store and say, hey, I've heard Aphex has this really cool thing out. Love to check it out. Do you think that that has minimized some of the
– to a degree, but I would say that I'm not an equipment buyer. But I would say to you and Rob, there's a difference between reading about something and actually putting your hands on it and – actually listening to it.
Sure.
And so that's why the show is so important.
Yeah.
I would think for much more for people who purchase it and use the equipment rather than just the manufacturers.
Were people upset about the noise and the guitars and the NAMM kind of vibe?
It wasn't quite the same cacophony that you hear it as.
Because NAMM becomes just painful.
Yeah. No, you want to shoot yourself after a couple of days working NAMM. But it was very high noise on that.
And did you hear people complaining about it?
No.
No?
No. It was they remarked about it. And once we knew what their schedule was, the Gibson people,
mm-hmm,
we just planned our conversations around their demos. It was kind of funny, but, you know, we all got along.
Because they were also, I think, seeing your booth, they were also demonstrating Sonar 6 on the other side of you, right? Because I remember you were down, well, I don't know if you knew where the API booth was. But
yeah, so you were
Kind of like behind you. But because I just saw your sign, but because the reason why I mentioned that is because they were blaring straight into our booth.
The Gibson people.
Yeah, and the guitars. And I was like, you know, I brought a rack and I was going to show people this, you know, all this summing and all kinds of really neat tricks.
Yeah, good luck.
That's the whole thing. It was like, after a while, I didn't even try. I just, you know, basically explained what the buttons did.
You know what? My first few NAMM shows, I kind of made that mistake. You know, I figured I'm going to bring this real audiophile stuff in. And actually, it was in the early days with Waveframe at the AES show, too. You know, it's like, we're going to demonstrate the subtleties of a whisper.
Yeah.
And what a difference fixed rate sampling makes, you know, on a whisper or a breeze. We're going to take wind and run it through reverb and listen to the purity as we drop the pitch. And you get in there and the gear didn't even have to be turned on. You couldn't have heard anything anyway. It was just completely impossible. At a trade show, you need to just basically get rid of subtlety and hit people over the head, unfortunately.
Yeah. And for me, what was really funny was, you know, I had this really nice DSM system that was showing people around. A lot of people were interested in my rack that was right next to it because it was even a smaller version of that. And I got a lot of students that were coming around and talking about it. And API gear, you know, it's not cheap. It's good. It's fairly expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're like, man, they're looking at that, but you can tell it's not registering as a purchase like tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But then they see my rack on the side that I'm running everything with it, and it has like a little, you know, little sub mixer, a little 8200A, a little aux mixer with the A to D digital converter, and they're like, oh, wow, look at that. And I go, yeah, and it's hooked up to my laptop and the whole thing. So I ended up
they can relate to that better.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm doing demos for the rack that's on the side than the big rack that's there. But the funny part was is I go, you know, I bring all these different files and stuff to demo with, and I get there, and I look at the speakers, and they're the little M-Audio speakers that they provided me.
Oh, great.
It's like, well, can you turn it up? No, that is up. Because we've got Gibson over here and Sonar, you know, doing a big demo. And so it was just, after a while, it was just great. It's just great to meet people. It's amazing to talk
to about a lot. It's about a lot more than just the gear.
I think it's networking. I mean, for me, I think when I go to AES, I meet up with friends that I already know, whether it be manufacturers or other artists. And then I also, I mean, I do go around to the booths, try to get an idea of what, strange enough, I want to focus on when I get back. Because for me, the best way for me to try out gear is in my studio with material that I'm familiar with,
right,
speakers I'm familiar with, a quieter environment, and then put it through the paces that of what I normally do or how I would use the gear. But it's great to start making the short list of, okay, you know, what am I going to buy next year, or what am I?
Or even the stuff you want to get into your studio to hear in your environment.
You mean the end of the year purchases? I mean the.
That's right.
No, but no, yeah, absolutely.
I actually have a question for Marvin. How important? It's probably changed thanks to the internet, but how important as a manufacturer are trade shows for you to know what the competition's doing and, you know, the way the whole industry is moving? Do you ever get surprised at a trade show, or these days can you pretty much figure it out beforehand?
Surprised when I see a manufacturer has copied one of my products.
Oh, that's delightful.
That, you know, that it's a Behringer. I'll name it. I'm not ashamed.
Well,
to
they're famous for that, aren't they?
Isn't pretty much everybody like just wants to go after them a little bit? Because I know so many companies have been.
Was that at this show that you found?
No, no, he doesn't have a show at a serious trade show. The AES is, I consider, still has some basis in academia.
Yeah, it does.
And it is a meeting of minds and an exchange of ideas, not theft of products. You know, I have been surprised in that way.
That has to be a very awful surprise.
Yes, shocking. Mm-hmm. But I don't use it. Sure, you look around, see what other people are doing. What was interesting for me, we introduced a 64-channel bidirectional snake. And it's a competitive product to something that Roland makes. And two engineers from Roland were crawling all over it, and the engineer that I had up there was explaining everything.
Wow, didn't you want to, like, hit the off button?
No.
That's pretty funny.
I will honestly say, I wasn't at this AES, but every trade show I've ever been at, the last day of the show, you're basically demoing to your competitors, to anyone who was able to escape from their booth, to go out and, you know, everybody kind of does it. Everybody's learning what everybody else is doing. And if they don't do it at the show, they're going to find it out on the internet.
That's where I had a whole swarm of Digi. Okay, Steinberg was next to us, and Digi was diagonal from us. So towards the end of the last day, a whole slew of Digi people came by. And
I'm sure they did.
So we're showing them some of the new stuff that API introduced, like the 5500 EQ. It's their dual EQ. And the A to D, and just, you know, all the different gear that they have. But, you know, speaking of the internet and trade shows, one thing that I noticed was how many people don't have literature but simply say, well, you can just go to our website and
really
download stuff. Yeah.
They don't do the big crazy color brochures?
You know what?
It's so expensive to print.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so expensive to ship.
Right.
I mean, you pay lots of money to bring that stuff just from the dock onto your booth, and then you wind up turning around and shipping it home.
Yeah,
Yeah.
A
lot of people ran out of stuff, I noticed.
Well, I know, like at API, they didn't print anything up. They only had like a one sheet on some of their new stuff, but everything else was just go to the website and just read about it. You can download the brochure. You can download the manual on a lot of the stuff. So it made a lot of sense, too, though. I didn't have to have a bag that was full of all these, you know, brochures that you end up throwing away anyhow.
But you know what? And it is true. You can look on the web, but there's – I mean, I realize I'm an uber geek here, but – there's nothing like at the end of the trade show going through the bag of brochures and just
you
flipping through the stuff.
You are an uber geek. No,
well, I know that. That's not
bathroom
news.
Reading, huh?
Well, that's not news that I'm an uber geek, but I just still like that.
Mike and I were more interested in getting a beer at the end of the show.
That's right. When I was done, man, all I wanted to do was get the heck out of there and find a cab.
Now, you know what I did notice, though, is so that which is a little bit newer, is digital output microphones. I know the KM184D. It's very intriguing, being somebody who records a lot, hearing stuff that supposedly has more dynamic range, more resolution, yada, yada, yada.
Yeah.
I don't know if it sounds any better, but I know high on my list is to start checking out a lot of the new digital microphones, as well as it's amazing the burst of technology in the microphone business, everything from the Chinese market with SE Electronics to DPA and Neumann. I mean, it's a lot of choices out there, a lot of colors, a lot of textures, and I'm pretty excited about trying them all out.
Well, there's one thing that was really cool, too, is did you see that Korg? Korg had new micro recorders.
Yes.
Did you see that?
Yeah,
and they're DSD recorders?
Yes.
Are they really?
Yeah. One bit. Little, the size of the micro track that I had.
Mm-hmm.
Little smaller guys that record one bit DSD.
DSD is still the most amazing thing I've heard in a long
time. Yeah, but nobody.
But the thing is it comes
it
with
software.
It puts
on WAV files, though.
Yeah. Well, and
it does?
And it has software. It does DSD streams, and it also has software that will convert it to WAV files.
Because nobody can edit DSD.
Yeah, but DSD is like – that's like a
– Well, you can't edit it, and you can't mix it very easily.
Well, and quite frankly, it's SACDs, they're going away. You're not going to see those pretty much anymore.
Nobody talks about them anymore.
Yeah. And they sound phenomenal. I mean – you can hear, they're just phenomenal sounding, but there's just no market for them. So I'm just wondering, that was just kind of odd, I thought, to bringing out something like that. It was impressive. They were small, but I don't know. We'll have to see where that goes.
I mean, everybody's trying to come out with new standards. I mean, you still got the Blu-ray DVDs, and then you've got high def DVDs.
Right.
And we're still on the brink of, who's going to win.
I'm still investing heavily in SACD and Beta.
Beta, yeah, hey.
Beta's coming back.
Beta's coming
on his way back.
Beta's coming back.
But maybe we should add that to the giveaway. I do actually have two Beta Hi-Fi decks if anyone needs them. No. Kidding.
Well, I will say, though, that AES, as far as gear for me, I didn't get to see a lot of it. I actually found myself going online and, Gear Slats and Harmony Central and just kind of reading about what other people saw at the trade show.
I actually gave a lecture at AES.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, I did meet Scott over at AES, ran into him, and he told me about his lecture. I go, what time's your lecture? And this was Saturday when I met him. And he goes, 8:30 a.m. on Sunday.
Oh, nice.
And I said, okay, well, say hi to the four people that are here.
We actually had almost 100 people.
Well, that's good.
Kind of blew us away. Actually started at 9, I found out.
The entire catering staff.
Yeah, I was going to say, all the people that didn't go out on Saturday.
Yeah, we're all kind of like, oh, hi, welcome to our lecture.
Speaking of going out on Saturday, I'm going to do a little sidebar. It has nothing to do with audio, but I find totally amazing that in San Francisco, the cable, the trolleys, the cable cars,
mm-hmm.
You can still ride those things and you can stand on the outside of them as they go up and down those hills.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just amazed that nobody has complained that you could do something that dangerous, because when they pass each other, you only got...
Oh, yeah, it's scary.
I'm thinking, San Francisco, how long is it going to be until somebody just says something or some kid falls out or something? It was fun. I rode right up in the front. I'm hanging off the side and, this is great.
There are much more dangerous activities in San Francisco.
Well, that's true, too. That's true. That's so funny you said that, too. Because off the air, I got to tell you a story. But, but anyhow, yeah, AES was definitely an experience. And all in all, I found out that this was my first experience actually demoing at a trade show. And I'm not a good demoer.
No?
No, because I tend to...
We gave you all kinds of advice.
You did. And I wanted to tell you guys that I can demo equipment, but I find it more interesting to start to talk to these people and to find out their story. And meanwhile, people are coming in and out of the booth. Yeah. And
there was that $80,000 sale.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
But at least I found out what this guy had for breakfast.
That's right. It was just, I'm too social or something, because I was just having fun meeting these people and talking. Mm-hmm. I mean, the guys that I did talk to and I could demo it, we had a good time, but I don't have that, like, that killer sales thing where you just have to, in the middle of it, someone's starting to look and touch knobs. Okay, well, hey, I'll talk to you later, and you go to the next
day.
Yeah.
No, it's hard.
You know, I failed in that respect. I would practically tell this person my life story. Hey, yeah, and hey, you can come down to the studio, and hey, here's my email address, and here's my cell phone, and yeah, hey, you want me to wire it? Okay.
but did you do the trade show look? That's talking to somebody and not looking at them, but scanning. It's kind of like doing the Stevie head thing, but actually looking around while you're doing it. You know, it's
Marvin, but don't you – you've probably been to – more of your show.
Too many.
Seriously, don't you ever, like, sometimes you just meet somebody and you just get engaged in a conversation and then everybody else just kind of just goes around and I don't know. I found that happened more than once.
Well, I've been in the industry long enough where I have a lot of contacts between reps and distributors and users and I know I offend people by not paying attention to somebody I've known for 30 years.
Right.
You know? So whoever's out there listening and who I may have offended, I'm sorry. but it's really impossible to just cut a conversation short and say goodbye, I'll catch you later.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Have you found any one of the trade shows more beneficial for you as a manufacturer than another? Can you even say that politically?
NAB is much more a sales for sales purposes because the money's bigger. I mean, we sell $8,000 broadcast processors. We sell $6,000 preamps. You know, where if we go to a NAM show and I'm selling $100 pedals, yeah, sell an awful lot of pedals to make up for one preamp. And also I found that the quality of people that come to an NAB in terms of their engineering chops typically is much higher than other shows.
Do you find that AES and NAB are kind of merging where the same people go to both? Or – I mean, obviously NAM has become much more the music market and the MI and a little lower-priced industry. But when you look at the two professional conventions, which is pretty much AES and NAB, what are your thoughts between the two?
I don't see a merger. Some broadcasters, local broadcasters, came to the AES. Mm-hmm. And very, very few people in the recording industry go to the NAB. So there's still a separation.
Is there still a big audio presence at NAB?
There's the radio hall. And
which is pretty small, though, isn't it?
I think it used to be more major when workstations were a brand new idea. There was a lot of buzz about them. And at an NAB show, they, you know, a lot of the conversation was about the audio side of things. But I think everybody's pretty used to disc recording at this point, and there's
well,
not
the big
the new
thing,
exciting
the,
thing.
The big thing for the broadcast world is multi-channel sound. And that's created a lot of problems and issues for people. And, you know, Rob, you're doing multi-channel. You know, mm-hmm. It's a lot different than just mixing stereo.
Yeah, and Scott's been doing it forever.
And then transmission of multi-channel is a big issue as well.
Yeah.
Dolby E
and the issue, of course, going in and out of Dolby E and then going to Dolby Digital. How many times can you touch it before it falls apart?
Right.
You know, those are big issues that every major broadcaster is dealing with. And so anyway, there is audio concern in that world.
Now, with the impact of satellite radio – sorry. With the impact of satellite radio and internet radio, have you found that the products are going – are skewing more towards those mediums than traditional mediums, you know, of old?
Radio still is a viable medium. Just read something that when the plane crashed in New York, everybody tuned in to WINS, and that's their news station. Mm-hmm. You know, that still is viable and vital. And I think a lot of people have turned off from radio because of the processing that's on so many radio stations sounds so bloody awful. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, that sound has migrated into the studio, and everybody's trying to achieve that thickness, undifferentiated,
low dynamic
blob. Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to take a break right now, and then when we come back, we're going to talk about Aphex, and we're going to talk about how you're changing that in the radio world. And
let me just tell
you, and let me just tell you, these boxes sound great. I just want to stay here and just listen to my voice going.
Yeah, I'm scared to hear what we're all going to sound like during the break.
I know.
It's going to get so boring.
As soon as we take off our headphones, all of a sudden we're going to go, hey, how's it going? All right, so we'll see you on the other side, and we're going to take a break right now.
Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the L.A. area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
That's right. It's all Spanish. No tengo. That's about all Spanish.
I was going to say, I've never even heard you speak Spanish. I've only known you 15 years.
Oh, really? Hey, welcome back to the Audio Nowcast. And we've had a really good first half talking about the AES. We talked about everything but gear because, quite frankly, if you want to find out about any of the gear that was at AES, there's great resources on the web like Gear Sluts or Harmony Central or... any other place that you guys can think of?
Well, the various magazines all have websites.
Well, Mix Online and all those. That's true. That's true. How can I forget? Well, we're here with Marvin Caesar from Aphex. And basically, we're going to talk about Aphex. And a couple things that come to mind right off the bat is if you've worked in music for any amount of time, you've used the Arl Exciter and its various incarnations. And right now, Marvin, why don't you just give us a little bit of a thumbnail history of Aphex and the company that you founded.
Well, first of all, the name Aphex is an acronym for Oral Perception Heterodyne Exciter.
Really?
I had no idea.
I couldn't make that up.
Wait, one more time?
Oral Perception Heterodyne Exciter.
Wow. That's a Trivia Pursuit question.
Yeah,
right there.
Definitely.
And I met the inventor in 1975. I was living in upstate New York, and I was actually trying to develop an alternative energy community. And I had no idea about music or anything other than I went to Woodstock, got stoned, had a great time. And So when he approached me on this, he was just looking for a passive investor. And he essentially told me that with $5,000 we'd make $1 million. I have an accounting background, so that sounded like a great return.
Wait, did you have to crunch the numbers and just spend all night?
Those were the years before calculating. So I pulled out my abacus and and anyway, I got involved and we got started and with very limited funds, and we didn't have enough money to get into production. So our thought was to just build enough units and rent them out. And our first big break was the Paul McCartney and Wings tour. And we got on that, and we rented it for $200 a month for the unit. And Peter Asher heard a piano that had been out on a previous tour and said, wow, how'd you get that sound? They pointed to this device. And he said, can that be recorded? And my partner, Kurt, said, sure. And we ran down to the sound factory where Linda Ronstadt was recording Hasten Down the Wind. And the second half of the album was put through the Oral Exciter. The difference was so dramatic that they had to go back and remix the first half.
Wow, that's amazing.
And our first concept was to charge $10 a minute. and we handed them a bill for 39 minutes, which was $390. And they looked at us and said, you guys are crazy. You should charge three times as much. Okay. And it became $30 a minute. And
that's awesome.
And this is because you – why weren't you selling the boxes?
Because we didn't have enough money to go into a full production run.
Oh,
that's awesome.
And then when we got away with that, we just kept on doing it for several years. And it became, you know, Linda Ronstadt, the Rumors album, James Taylor, JT – all these albums all said mixed with the Aphex Oral Exciter, and it was so popular that the Eagles, the Long Run, said mixed without the Aphex Oral Exciter.
Really? Now that's funny.
That's funny.
And I used that as demo material to show them how good it could have sounded.
That's awesome. Hey, really quick, why don't you explain to us what the Oral Exciter did or does and still does today?
It's doing it right now on this podcast, actually.
What it does, it splits the signal into two paths. One path goes to output unmodified, the other path through a high-pass filter, then a harmonics generator, and then mix back into the unmodified signal. The key is that the harmonics generator, we call a transient discriminant harmonics generation. And what we're looking for are transients at the input and building them up. But by doing it in the sidechain, there is a slight time delay through the filter. So the harmonics are slightly phase shifted. So we're not building up a lot of amplitude, but we're putting a sharpening signal, if you will, into the audio. So for speech in particular, what's critical for intelligibility is consonant recognition, and the consonants have the leading edges. And so what we're doing is actually building up the leading edges. In acoustic instruments, it just makes things more open sounding, is hearing the details. And that's what the Oral Exciter does. It shouldn't be a gross EQ effect.
Right.
It just should be more open, more detailed.
Yeah, that's because that's – you know, I've tried to explain to people what the sound is, and the only thing I can tell them is it gives a presence. It just, there's something about the sound, an openness to the sound. You know, and the first time I heard it, I was just amazed to just how it works.
And
it doesn't, because it would have that, it doesn't kill you on the frequencies like any, like 2K, 4K, anything like that, and yet you get a tremendous sense of presence, you know, especially in those frequencies.
There are other devices that purport or try to trade on that effect.
Right.
And they boost the high end by as much as 14 dB.
Wow.
And so if you're in the speaker reconing business, you want to sell a lot of those devices. And that effect is actually quite dramatic on those devices. But if you have an infinite headroom, that's great.
Right.
But most people don't. So the Oral Exciter, the same effect, you get about a 2 to 3 dB increase.
Wow. That's great. Well, hey, listen, I didn't want to interrupt you. I just wanted people to know what the Oral Exciter was.
Sure.
So we last left off at Eagles not using it.
Just around the early 80s, the record companies actually had some problems because they were getting more returns than they actually printed. There were so many – I don't know if you guys remember those days, but they were having a lot of trouble. And there was an identifiable line item in the budget for the record, which was the Oral Exciter. So that it got harder and harder to rent it. So we decided to sell it. And so that rental stock, which we did quite well on, we turned around and sold. And then we've gone through various iterations over the years. And I can say that the unit that sells on the street for about $200 is actually better sounding than the unit we rented for $30 a minute.
Wow.
Wow.
Wow, that's pretty good. So we're getting a bargain nowadays.
Absolutely.
Now the unit that's out right now, is it still Is it the C? Is it still the C?
No, you're back in the 90s.
Yeah, I am. See?
It's the Model 204.
204.
Yes, and what we did was we added a base processor, and it's called the Big Bottom. And the 204 has an optical element to achieve the Big Bottom effect. And that's also a dynamic effect where you get more base density without increasing peak. So that's one of the things that always drives levels crazy when you try to get more base. And that doesn't happen.
Wow. So. I'll have to try that because
we are trying it. The reason that you wanted to go out dating tonight
with your new voice,
with
my new voice, hey,
was specifically because of the Big Bottom.
No,
and I wish you luck tonight.
Yeah, I'm sure my wife doesn't wish me luck. But well, just goes to show you that because the one that I've got the C. It's a workhorse. It's, you know, those things work forever. And you go to every studio.
I'll do you a deal on a new one.
One thing that I want to mention is just the tremendous amount of impact that you've had on recorded music. You'd have an easier time finding the albums that it wasn't used on than you would to the albums that were used. As the founder, how does that make you feel? I imagine you have a tremendous sense of pride that you've been able to have that kind of an impact on music.
That's been a source of pride. I'm very pleased that I've been able to be part of producing in some small way better music and better sound. One of the other things that's always been my dream is to have the Oral Exciter part of telephony and actually more importantly hearing aids. Because we have proof that we did a study that it does work for slightly hearing impaired people. And those people who, as we all get older, and listening to headphones rather loud and going to a lot of rock concerts, we all have damaged our hearing.
Now, I've noticed that the Exciter has been licensed to a lot of different manufacturers and a lot of different companies. Are there any manufacturers that come to mind that use it in ways that you hadn't thought of before or in-
Well, McKenzie Labs uses it for their message on hold machines. So,
really?
Yeah, and you know, here you have a very limited bandwidth medium just on landlines. We're not talking about cell phones here. Right. We're talking landlines. It's still bandwidth limited, and even though it's so bandwidth limited on the head end of the transmission, putting the Oral Exciter on still works. One of the nice things has been all the train stations in Paris use the Oral Exciter because they have to the one story in particular is the Gare du Nord, where it's outdoors. It's a residential neighborhood, and whenever they played their announcements, it was too loud and annoyed the neighbors. They lowered the levels and put the Oral Exciter in, and it works better than louder signals.
Wow. Oral Exciter changing the world, not just music.
What was the next big step for Aphex from the Oral Exciter?
The next big step was developing our VCA, and which was cleaner and faster and had less DC offset than other VCAs at the time. Mm-hmm. And as a result of that VCA, I came into contact with Don Werbeck, who was a broadcast engineer in Hawaii. And if you think my ability to sell audio gear is good. I was able to sell somebody to come from Hawaii and come here and work for me. But his first device that he brought on board was the Compeller, which is a combination of compressor leveler, if you're interested in the etymology of that name. And then he brought on the Dominator, and then we had the Expressor. And one of the things that the other thing was Logic Assisted Gate and Easy Rider Compressor. I mean, we have well over 20 patents.
What year was that? That was in the
1985.
Yeah, I was going to say that was in like the late 80s. You started seeing all those products come out.
Right.
You know, all the ores.
The other product that you see in every single studio is the plus four minus yes. 10 box, the original one. I know there's
that's kind of boring, but it works.
But it's one of those one of those pieces of gear though that you see every single place.
I mean, I personally own eight. I mean, it's just
I've got a bunch of them too.
And you know, think about it, but that's the cool thing.
And it's, and they sound good. And
they sound great.
They do sound great.
And that's one of the things that I'm proud of. I just won't put out anything that doesn't sound great.
Yeah.
Although a 10-4 box or a distribution amp, you know,
it may not be the sexiest piece of gear, but you know what?
It's
when you need one, you need one.
Well, which is a good spot right now because most people, you know you for the Exciter. But why don't you talk about all the different gear that you guys made? I just had no idea.
Well, we're in a lot of different markets. We started in the recording market, then the touring sound. We got into broadcast. And I was rather distressed about 4 or 5 years ago because everything was migrating towards computer-based processing. It sounded like poop to me, but that's where it was going. I couldn't fight it. I just felt like I was putting my finger in the dike. And so who cares about their audio? The musicians themselves. You know, I couldn't talk to a radio engineer. I couldn't talk to a recording engineer. The mastering engineer say, hey, you know, I'm just being told to crunch this and right. make it as loud as possible. But the musicians themselves care about the audio, their own sound. So we got into the pedal business. And so we developed the Exciter pedals and an amazing compressor, an optical compressor called the Punch Factory. And for people who would normally shy away from compressors on their instruments, I defy them to actually hear this thing working. And it's kind of fun. But that's just one little sideline. And then we have the mic preamps,
right.
Ranging from and Rob should talk to this about the 1100 and what – you know, when it'll just sound like hype from me.
Right.
So I'll let it sound like hype from Rob.
the first mic pre that I used from Aphex was the 1788. And the reason I needed that is when I put together my new studio, I knew that there might be times when I wanted to have the mic pre in a tracking room
right.
and have an A to D in it and be able to remote control the mic pre and just bring the digital signal back to the control room. And the 1788 was introduced to me, and everybody was saying it sounded great. And I was interested, obviously, in something that sounded great, but I needed the feature set of being able to remote control it.
Yeah.
And then bring a digital signal straight out of the mic pre for
yeah,
a long run.
I think we should mention that because, A, I'm looking at a picture of it in a brochure right now, and it's a great-looking piece of gear. But, B, just to have 8-channel remote control,
it's the coolest thing
really
ever.
Really cool. Well, that's really cool.
There are several inventions in there. I mean, one of our marketing ideas is to never do anything that anybody can copy. Because we've been so burned. But so one of the inventions is the ability to adjust the gain without any clicks or pops. You take a Digi preamp, for example, the remote control preamp. They have 3 dB steps. So that makes sure that you cannot, in the middle of a session, adjust the gain.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
The other feature is the McLim. And that's a limiter in front of the preamp. So you can slam this thing and never overload.
Wow.
So in the middle of a session, you don't have to say, oh, damn, that was great. I have to go back again.
No, that works really, really well.
Especially for drums. A guy like Ricky Lawson will not record without it.
Wow.
The ADR engineer at Sony Pictures, Howard London,
right.
uses it. And, you know, it's great when you don't have to tell an actor, hey, that was really a wonderful performance. Could you do it again? And he said now he's working so quickly, he's aging more slowly.
But you know what? That makes sense though, because when you're in an ADR session and you need, you know, screams or efforts or whatever, I can't tell you how many times when I've recorded some ADR where, you know, it's just gone over because the dynamic range that they're performing at. So to have a limiter before the preamp, that is really cool.
What Howard said is he was always proud of his ability to read body language and know when the actors were going to let loose.
Right.
And he had to be very dexterous and pull back all the preamps before. Now he has it on one knob and it just pulls back all three, four, five mic preamps without any zip noise or clicks or pops. And now he's got a DM2000, and we're MIDI mapping the DM2000. So it, rather than a knob, he has a fader.
So he's running a fader to control the mic preamp from –
one fader to control four or five mic preamps at the same time.
That's really cool.
That stuff all works really well. I'll tell you a way we used the 1788 not too long ago because the album just came out now. On Peter Frampton's new album, we recorded some of the percussion – through the 1788s, and we had a percussionist set up a bunch of stuff. We set up a bunch of mics, and then I had presets as we'd move from song to song or whatever, presets that brought up the different channels as appropriate for whatever the percussionist was playing. If he's on congas, then the conga levels get set right. If he moves over to his toy table, you know, that gets set right. And so the ability to be able to sort of store presets and also to have the mic pre in the room with him with remote metering – on a computer.
Right.
It's just really, really cool.
That's fantastic. Yeah. That's time saving.
And we've actually, Marvin and I have done some large scale live concert recording, like 96 tracks using a whole wall of these 1788s with remote metering and remote control from the recording truck to the mic pre's that are on the side of the stage. I mean, we could probably talk about it for about 7 hours, but It's really cool to have an amazing studio quality mic pre with remote control like that that also has digital outs.
Well, yeah, just for the snapshots. And digital outs too?
Yeah.
There are two analog outputs and three digital outputs. And the idea is if anybody has mixed live and knows the effect of splitting the signal into the mic signal into two or three or four preamps, it's an amazing thing when you just load the microphone into an ideal load. Everything opens up, the transient response, the frequency response.
Wow.
It's not even subtle. You can hear it instantly.
Wow, that's – wow.
So that's one unit. We could go on up. And it's used certainly for various applications. And just this week, Barbara Streisand was recorded – by FNL with the 1788s.
Wow.
And I'll also just give a little shout out to the 1100, which is a little one rack space mic pre that is just absolutely incredibly cool for a stereo mic pre. We use that a lot too.
What was the mic pre that you had with two Bessons?
That was the model 107. We don't use that name anymore because Thermionics.
The reason is we've got a bank of four of them at our Foley stages.
They're fabulous.
They're fabulous.
The 107s, thing with the XLR in front.
I know they're rack mounted.
Yes.
But I know that we, you know, they're, is it blue?
You have the 1100s then.
I guess so.
Yeah, I think you do have the 1100s.
Yes,
yes.
You got the 1100s. You didn't even know it.
Yeah,
but now there's the 1100 Mark II.
And we got four of them then. Yeah.
They're great.
And do you notice how detailed they are?
They are. I mean, it's something that – because we put a lot of very non-fundamental – we're like the worst nightmare for sound because we are literally making noise, smashing things, footsteps, dirt, high transients, high harmonics – and not great environments. We're creating all this on a Foley stage, and it has to be dead quiet because I'll do 60-100 tracks of Foley easy, and it just can't add up, and it's just got to be clean, and you know.
Yeah, it works. It's the EIN shorted, the equivalent input noise shorted is -135.
Wow.
Yeah, it's insane. Yeah. It adds less than a dB of noise to a microphone.
Wow.
Well, I just want to encourage people, if you want to find some really cool gear, you need to visit their website because it has all their products and plus the little history of the company and stuff. It's really cool.
As much as I appreciate you saying that, Mike, what is more impressive to them, if they could get their hands on it, don't buy it. Do not buy any piece of gear from me or from anybody else until you try it in your own environment and understand what the application is. And, once you do, then you can make your own judgments.
Yeah, that's true too. I think people just need to know that you're more than just the exciter company.
Well, we didn't even talk about dynamics. You have the compeller, you have the dominator.
Let's talk about that.
You have the easy rider, you have the logic assisted gate. So we have all these dynamics processing that has different applications.
Was the Expressor, is that renamed to something else now?
No, the Expressor is still the Expressor. But we've added quite some time ago the Easy Rider circuit to the Expressor.
What is the Easy Rider circuit? Why don't you tell us what
that
is?
The Easy Rider circuit, we call it a convoluted filter system where it sounds like a slow attack almost all the time, but when it needs to, it kicks into a faster attack time. If you had a slow attack compressor all the time, you'd have big overshoots.
Right.
And also these big overshoots would cause a downstream limiter to work very hard. So if you had a faster attack, it would choke and pump and breathe. So what we're listening to right now is the Easy Rider compressor. And on my voice right now, I'm hitting it about 12, 16 dB of gain reduction.
Wow.
Now, you do that just about any other compressor, you'll feel it. You'll feel that compression. And the whole idea of the Easy Rider is not to feel it. And also, because it's already somewhat peak processed, it's not going to fire off the limiters downstream and make it the average level lower. So it's a marvelous packaging device.
It's a great sound. The compression, you just do not hear it. And yet you don't sound clamped. You don't sound, crushed.
It got choked. And you don't lose the high end, obviously. There's not much music going on right now. But the idea is that you don't lose the articulation. And so we have the 230, which is what we're talking about right now, on a number of different applications, ranging from Rick D's, just put it on, and Tony Roberts.
Wow.
And he's a ridiculously wide dynamic range speaker.
Right.
He goes from a whisper to a scream mid-sentence. And the engineer said that he used to chase him all over the stage, with a fader, and now he's can sit back and relax. And perhaps most importantly, is for the first time in 15 years, he's been mixing him for 15 years. His ears don't ring at the end of the show.
Yeah. Wow, that is good.
And you were telling me the podcasting world is getting excited about this one, too.
Yeah, so we just did the portable media and podcasting show out in Ontario.
Yeah, I went to that. I saw your guys' booth there.
Yeah, and we were selected as best of show voice processor. And,
wow.
And it was very interesting to see how people reacted to it. You were talking before about the microphones coming out USB and so on. And and that was a comment that we had from a lot of people. Like, why should I just take that? Why shouldn't I just use a microphone with a USB output and put it into the editor instead of, spending $700 for this voice processor? And my comment to them was, well, you can't polish a turd. And when I told that story to a videographer at the AES, he said, but you can roll it in glitter.
Uh,
That is true.
Is there any plans in making anything portable? A battery operator or anything for us location guys?
We looked at that, and we just have so many other things that we're involved in that it would be yet another diversion. The major work that we did in the last year was developing that 64 channels bidirectional snake. That was a lot of work, and we didn't anticipate how long it would take.
And that was the main new product at AES, right?
That's correct.
For the sake of time, I've got two questions that I want to ask you. What do you think about the way audio is, the state of audio right now, and with all the MP3 players and just the quality and the whole thing? I want your spin on the whole state of audio.
Until you demonstrate A/B between what audio could sound like and what it does sound like through an MP3 player, people think, well, my MP3 sounds absolutely fine. And, you know, how do you reach everybody?
Right.
You know, how do you say, hey, listen to this and pay attention to the detail behind the instrument, the space. And we talked about earlier how people have the ability to create music in their living room or in their kitchen or wherever they're cooking it up. Yeah, that's great. And I think it's wonderful, but that's wonderful for electronic music. But if you're actually doing anything acoustic, you know, what about your sense of space? And how do you translate that sense of space in the medium? And so it's a loaded question. I think there's hope. And unfortunately, there are so many things that are affecting the quality of audio.
Right.
And I think one of the primary ones is the quest for loud.
Right.
And loud trumps everything, you know, because if you have two signals, one's louder than the other, the first impression is, oh, that sounds better. And if people could educate themselves to understand that loudness is not the primary quality, that they should have dynamics, that they need to have emphasis and syllabic emphasis and musical emphasis and make it interesting for people to go into a mix. If they could do that, that'd be wonderful.
It's like little baby steps. One thing that I've noticed with your company is being that you're on the production side, like the voice processors for the broadcasters, I think you're going to make an impact just from the fact that people are going to want to sound good. They're going to want to sound good, and then more broadcasters, you know, start using your gear and you know, people can really sense a difference in a quality that they don't get on maybe some other radio station. I think slowly but surely, you know, if you can start a little trend there of making people sound good.
It's the feeling that my fingers in the dike. And, what we have been trying to do is talk about benefit. For the 230, for example, how much easier it is to work the microphone,
right,
as compared to other just using a straight mic pre.
Right.
That if people can see that and get that message, then
we should also point out, I don't know how much detail we went into about what we're actually doing here tonight, but you know, we're each speaking through a 230.
Yeah.
And the total setup time to get the levels and the gates and compressors and everything else was what, 5 minutes?
If that. Yeah, it was pretty quick.
And we all heard the difference pretty immediately.
Yeah, it's amazing. This podcast has gone really well as far as not having to worry about working the mic because the compression. Remember the first time we podcasted, we tried to put a compressor on?
Oh, yeah.
We tried to put software compression and gate on all the channels because we were thinking to make it easy, and it was just a nightmare. It felt like our heads were exploding because the pumping was so bad. So we mixed that right off the bat.
Can we talk about that?
Absolutely.
Why? Do you have something to say about that, Marvin? I'm shocked. Yeah.
I brought a paper along written by Dan Mapes Reardon, and he talks about how digital would have to be sampled at 5 megahertz to be as clean as analog. And it's an AES paper. You could put that up on your website and make reference to it. But it's a fascinating thing, and the whole idea is to avoid aliasing distortion. And software designers recognize that they have to avoid aliasing distortion, and so they make slower attack times. However, the slower attack times would potentially cause big overshoots. So what they do is they use look-ahead.
Right. That's exactly what they do.
And what that is means that the attack time actually starts before the transient appears. So instead of it being a punchy, snappy sound, articulated transients, it sounds like everything hit a pillow. So
that's so true.
Yes. Well, that's why. And so people should understand when they start talking about, oh, I'll just do it in my console. I have a digital compressor in my console.
Right.
Or oh, I'll just stay in Pro Tools and use the plugin. Certainly in terms of mastering and when you're doing limiting, you have to know why your audio sucks.
It sucks because of those plug-in compressors.
Except, but it's pretty easy to demonstrate, you know, with the outboard stuff, with your analog processing, how much better it can be. It's not – these aren't like real tweaky audiophile differences necessarily. They can be pretty obvious.
Yeah. Well, I just want to encourage people to get down there and hear some Aphex gear because it's pretty darn phenomenal. One last thing that I wanted to ask you was what's the future? You know, is there anything you can talk about or any directions that you guys as a company are going? Or where's Aphex going in the next couple of years?
I think the next step, there's a major demand for multi-channel processing on air and in production. And there's nothing out there right now that works well. So that's something we have to be able to do. The first step, of course, is to be able to do SDI, unembed,
right,
do the processing and re-embed all in one package. And one of the nice things, that, as I said before, is the broadcasters are willing to spend money. So you give them a solution, because anybody who's listening to 5.1 at home broadcast, they know the levels are all over the place.
Right.
And any spots or any commercials it's the same reason that you need level control on mono or in stereo is the same reason you need level control in for multi-channel.
Yeah, I mean, as somebody who mixes a lot of 5.1, if you had a multi-channel of this thing, boy, I can have some fun with that, you know. So I agree.
Can you also just talk for a second about the Anaconda thing? Because I'm not sure if these guys are familiar with it, but that's a pretty cool new thing.
One of the problems with the 1788 is getting all this audio back to front of house or wherever you're sending it. We developed a snake where we have 64 channels bidirectional on fiber, multimode fiber. And it can run 2 kilometers, 1.2 miles.
Wow.
And the trick there is to be able to have all that audio and control and metering all in the fiber and clock all in the fiber.
And 64 channels both ways.
And no delay, no frame delay or anything?
No. It's a synchronous system. It's not network. As a matter of fact, at the AES show, Andrew Waterman, who mixes the halftime entertainment at the Super Bowls, we had a guitar playing into the preamp, from the preamp into the Anaconda, out of the Anaconda into Pro Tools and up on monitors. And he was moving his head back and forth between the guitar and the monitors and couldn't hear any latency.
Wow. That's amazing.
So that was very impressive for me and for him. Essentially, it's the number of clocks getting in, number of clocks getting out, which is a little bit more than a millisecond, and that's your latency.
Wow.
So, it's just ADAT in and out. So it's a relatively small, inexpensive way of doing it, and there's eight word clock outputs, and It's real simple, real clean, and I don't know what else to say.
That's pretty cool.
That's cool. Yeah, yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Well, hey, thanks, Marvin, for the second time. We're going to have to wrap this up, but thank you very much.
It's been a lot of fun. Thank you so much.
And you know what? We'll always have an open chair here. So, you know, if you ever have any more cool toys you want to come and bring in.
Actually, two open chairs, one for you and one for the rack of
that's right.
Voice Process.
Yeah, what people don't realize is that the rack is on its own chair.
With a mic.
That's right. I almost want to ask it a question, you know. But I just wanted to thank you for coming down and being here with us. I just want to remind everybody that we are giving away another DMP7 from Rob. Mm-hmm. So send us your emails at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. That's audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
And also other questions and comments. You don't have to take a DMP7 if you want to ask about something else.
That's true.
It's not mandatory.
Or you can pass it on to someone else.
There you go. That's to a friend or an enemy.
That's right. I'm just waiting for the email in a couple weeks after David gets his DMP7. I'm like, this thing sucks. Channel 7 doesn't even work anymore.
I guarantee Channel 7 will work as well as the rest of them. How's that?
All right. Well, guys, you have anything else to say before we go?
It's been a lot of fun.
All right. Well, this is Mike, Scott, Rob, and Marvin, and we'll just check you out next time. Thanks for listening.
Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. Thanks for listening to this week's edition of the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by West Wave Audio.